Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we're joined by Dr. Victoria Medland, an obstetrician working at Great Western Hospital in Swindon since February 2022. She began her training in 2011. I met Vicky when she attended my pregnancy and postnatal yoga classes in Bristol. I was really impressed with how she was passionate about supporting the women in her care to have an empowered and positive experience. Welcome, Vicky.
Good morning.
Hi, Vicky. Lovely to meet you.
So we would love to know, did you always want to be a doctor?
I probably had quite a normal upbringing for what lots of people think of when they think of doctors, but probably not a normal like upbringing in terms of what the reading material was around the house. So my mum was a GP and there was a stack of BMJs, British Medical Journals, that were always in the downstairs loo, which I probably wouldn't leave around for my kids. But it just meant that growing up around the idea of bodies and working parts and pathology and potentially things being wrong with people that you could maybe fix was something that I just grew up around, and a very factual approach to teaching about health at home. So it always seemed something that was possible to me, and also because it was my mum, not my dad, it was something that I could totally envisage doing in the future. But they weren't my only interests, and I did seriously consider doing music instead. That's not where I've ended up, clearly.
I hope you still get to do some music, but I think once a musician, you're always a musician, even if you end up with a different career.
Yeah, I was rehearsing last night, actually. It's something I've managed to get back into after having kids, at the behest of my brother, who is also heavily into music, but now also a doctor. So it's a really common combined passion of lots of people. If you go to university orchestras, there are many medics there.
I can believe it. I imagine the mental discipline you need in order to practice and improve at your instrument probably held you quite well as you were doing that very heavy going studying.
It's exactly that. It's knowing that delayed gratification, putting the work in now for the rewards later, and that kind of goes for taking any hobby really seriously. It doesn't have to be music, does it?
So then what was your training like?
At A level I took chemistry, biology, English literature and music, but still very much keeping the options open, and always being somebody that was kind of really interested in the human story, which I felt that I could get to grips with English literature, and probably influenced more of my medical journey than I would have realised it was going to at the time. And then got a place at Bristol, took a year out, worked a variety of jobs, which I would highly recommend to anybody considering doing medicine, because it's just important to know how the world works outside a hospital. So I was a waitress, I worked in a cake shop, I worked in a cocktail bar. That gives you lifelong skills. And I worked in a shoe shop, and I worked as a healthcare assistant, both in a nursing home and in a hospice, which were both probably quite formative experiences in terms of caring for somebody in a dignified way. And I, at that time, then thought that when I started doing, when I went to medical school, thought that I might actually be involved in care of the dying, because I thought that that was a really interestingly, it pertains to obstetrics as well. It was one of those formative experiences that you only get to do once and you can't redo it, so you need to get it right first time.
Mm-hmm.
So medical school was 6 years because I did an additional degree in the middle in pharmacology. The first 2 years were quite lecture-based, lab-based. It's quite a traditional course at Bristol, or at least it was then. And they taught us loads of things, which I look back now and think, if only I'd known then what I know now. So lots of things about illness behaviour, sick role in society, how people respond to traumatic experiences. But when you're 19 or 20 and you've not done clinical medicine, you don't really have anything to pin it on. And then did the year of pharmacology, in which I did a project with David Nutt, who is a psychopharmacology professor who now works in London. Lots of stuff about addiction and reward pathways, which was super interesting, gave me a taste of lots of interest in psychiatry. Came back to clinical medicine and started in Bath. As a medical student in Bath, we had a couple of weeks where we started to examine one another, because that's how you start doing your examination training. And one of my colleagues found that I had an abdominal tumour, which was a bit unexpected.
Whoa.
So then I went through a series of investigations, including being scanned by one of my mum's colleagues and then being seen by the colorectal surgeons in Cheltenham, because that's where my parents lived, and then having an MRI the day after my 21st birthday when I was quite hungover. It's not where you want to be with a hangover. It's very noisy. And then having a CT-guided biopsy and then having a laparotomy, so an up-down incision on my belly, and having that taken out in those summer holidays. So that was a bit of an eye-opener. Particularly about what the experience of being on a surgical ward is like, how vulnerable it makes you feel, how little you see the doctors, how much you see the nurses, how much that shapes your day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a 5-day inpatient stay. I didn't get out of bed for the first 3 or 4 days just because every time I sat up, my blood pressure plummeted and I felt really faint. I could hear mutterings about the fact that I hadn't got out of bed from over by the nurse's station. It makes me very aware of how much patients can hear when you're discussing them.
What an eye-opening experience. Yeah. So straight at the beginning of your kind of career, you hadn't even really started, you were still studying.
Yeah.
To have to go through that. That's like, whoa. Universe was really putting it on a plate, wasn't it, Vicky? Here it is. What do you think?
Yeah, it's quite a humbling experience being in an open mixed bay. You're not meant to have mixed bays anymore. I don't know what the rules were back in when I was 21. Going to the loo on a commode with a thin curtain between you and a stranger. It's,
slightly humiliating.
You're no one special in that moment.
Had you chosen to specialise in obstetrics at that point already?
No, and I hadn't done my obs and gynae placement, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought I might like paediatrics, but I wasn't sure. So, yeah, after that, I went and did, you kind of, in my first year of clinical, you kind of do all the general specialties. So you do general internal medicine, like cardiology, respiratory, general surgery, so vascular surgery and colorectal surgery and upper GI surgery. And then in the next year, we did the specialties, so things like anaesthetics, paediatrics, obs and gynae. We'd done psychiatry by that time as well, and then the last year was doing lots of clinical attachments and kind of consolidating it all and bringing it all together. By the end of my fourth year was just electrifying for me. It was a moment when I don't mean this literally because I'm not a coder, but it felt like I was starting to see code. I was like starting to see how it all fitted together, how all the pathology teaching fitted together with why people present in certain ways. And it was a really exciting time of lots and lots of connections being made. And I came out at the end of that year being like, I love anaesthetics, I love paediatrics, I love obs and gynae, I might do any of them. I was wide-eyed and overexcited. And then final year was a lot of revision and choosing your clinical placement. So you basically get ranked. At that time, you got ranked in quartiles of the year, and depending on what your score was, meant that you could choose a particular deanery to train in. So Bristol, Gloucester, all of the hospitals local to us are 7 deanery. And I managed to get a place in 7 deanery. And then you get a rotation of jobs for your first 2 years afterwards that you get to choose. So I managed to choose a rotation that contained both paediatrics and obs and gynae, and they came at the in my second year.
Wow, what a fascinating journey. Just listening to you speaking, I want to go and have a look at some of those books on your shelf behind you and start having a rummage through. And oh wow, the amount of information in your brain is just phenomenal.
I mean, it's not all there anymore, but I am lucky to have a good long-term memory. So my husband will always win at the exams. He'll get 95% plus. He can cram a huge amount of information in one go, but it doesn't stay. I can pass the exam respectably, but 5 to 10 years later we'll still have retained a number of facts that he is pretty sure he never knew. People work in different ways.
Definitely. Oh, so when did you meet your husband?
Oh, I met him at the beginning of that fourth year of medicine. And he had done a PhD in child psychology and was working as a documentary researcher in London, and then became gradually disillusioned with working in telly and gradually more and more interested in what I was doing. And obviously that was a time when I was really enjoying studying. So obviously he went back to medical school just as I graduated. I'd never intended to marry a doctor, but that is how things panned out. And actually him doing psychiatry has had a huge impact on the conceptualization of my job. So actually, whilst at the time I thought, oh no, we're going to be two doctors, how is this going to work? His job and lots of what he reads and that kind of cross-pollination has really shaped who I am as a clinician.
As we'd sort of say, with the yoga perspective, it unfolded just as it was meant to. And sounds like, yeah, you were definitely guided by the universe there to be with the person that would take you on the next stage of your journey. When did you decide to have children?
Oh, so I was really lucky. I did my first year of obs and gynae training was half at St Michael's in Bristol and half in Swindon, and then a year at Southmead, and then I became a registrar again at Southmead, and then I did a clinical teaching fellow job in St Michael's. And in that clinical teaching fellow year, in a very goal-orientated way, I was like, I'm going to get my clinical teaching qualification. I'm going to do my DFSRH, which is a contraception diploma, because I thought that that would be a really useful thing to pick up. And I also decided that I was going to get my membership exams that year in a kind of tick, 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 doesn't life pan out how you want it to sort of way. And I worked really hard that year and I got it done. And just as I was revising for my membership exams, I kind of thought, I wonder whether or not now would be a good time to have a baby. And came off contraception and got pregnant first cycle.
Wow.
Which always makes you wonder whether or not you were really ready for that.
Well, we always hear the stories of the time it takes and people who have difficulties and, you know, contraception's staying in your system for some time and all the rest of it. The story of it happening straight away is not a commonly told one, and yet it is quite a common occurrence, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think also you just think that obviously I see people who have problems with their fertility, because that you don't present with it all being fine. So that was a bit of a shock. And I'd done the writtens for my for my membership exam, but I still had the OSCE to go, which meant that, and they're kind of paired. You have to pass, or back then you did, you had to pass the writtens and then pass the Viva in one go. And if you failed the Viva, you had to go back and resit the writtens, which I really didn't want to do. I can remember being really, really tired in early pregnancy in a way that I will admit I'd never really sympathised with before that moment. And falling asleep in the middle of revision sessions, just coming back from a full-time job, falling asleep, waking up again, revising, falling asleep, going to work, arriving in the car park at work at 10 past eight with a shift that started at 8:30 and setting my alarm for 10 minutes of extra sleep in the car. Dry heaving on the pavement, going in, working. Yeah, that was really tough. And shift work in early pregnancy is vile. Nobody is sicker than somebody who's 9 weeks pregnant at 5 a.m.
Yeah. All the crackers in the world are never going to help you with that, really, are they?
Well, I mean, if you even have time to eat them, right? Yeah. You're just cheeking Buccostem and going on to see the next patient.
Oh, so did pregnancy get easier as you moved into your second trimester?
Yes, yeah, it did. So I passed those exams. I can remember probably the last time I really suffered with sickness was going to Madeira as a little post-exam celebration. Didn't feel great there. It was about 14 weeks, and from then afterwards felt much better. Yeah, kind of became aware of what high levels of estrogen do to you in terms of sense of well-being and, shall we say, zest for life? We'll go with that. So it felt much better kind of in that mid-trimester, and then just very tired towards the end. And because it was pre-COVID, I worked till 36 weeks. So there were definitely times when I was working, when I was delivering babies, that were less cooked than mine was. You know, you look in the notes and this person's got a due date later than your baby has, and here they are in preterm labour, or, you know, needing to have a baby early because they're not very well.
How did you find, like, the processing of that, you know, kind of, obviously you must get trained that that's someone else's journey, but how did you find that impacted your thoughts or feelings?
No one trains you that it's someone else's journey. That is something that you come to that realization, but nobody specifically goes out of their way to train you as an obstetrician about what that's going to feel like to train somebody else who might have too much in common with you at that moment. That's just, you know, you walk into a room and it becomes apparent that, you know, this is potentially going to be a difficult consultation. Like, also, I can remember a day where I counselled three women who had had intrauterine deaths when I was visibly very pregnant.
Oh, no.
And I said to each one of them, you can see another clinician if you like. I understand that this is a difficult interaction. I am visibly very pregnant. I'm happy to go through this consultation with you if you want, but I'd really understand if you'd rather see someone else. And all of them actually said, thanks very much for acknowledging it, carry on. Mm-hmm. Because I guess at least you're meeting an awful situation with some awareness and humanity, and you can't really ask for more than that in that moment. But I can remember there was I was asked to go and do, to help a woman who needed an assisted birth. And I was pregnant, the paediatrician was pregnant, the midwife was pregnant, the woman was pregnant. The only person that wasn't pregnant in the room was her husband. I just remember saying to him, like, the only person in the room that isn't pregnant right now, how's that feel? I kind of looked around him and there's just bumps everywhere. It was great. It felt like a real moment of sisterhood.
Oh,
I love that. I love that so much. And just thinking of all the little babies inside all being in that room at that moment, sort of waiting for the emergence of one of them.
I wonder how many of those babies are going to go on to become midwives or obstetricians or doulas.
Well, the midwife in question, I think, is a really inspirational midwife. I would be astonished if one of her children doesn't end up working in the birth world somehow.
Oh, wonderful. So how did becoming a mother change you?
I thought quite a lot about what I wanted the birth to look like. And it didn't completely go according to plan, but I was absolutely fine with it. I felt safe the whole way through. I think a massive eye-opener was two things. One was I am used to seeing women who are having an extremely long latent phase. And often they're having a really long latent phase because the biomechanics aren't quite right, or potentially because there's a background infection there, which is something that I always have to consider. So when I laboured from nothing to fully in 2 hours, that was a shock, both intellectually. I was like, this doesn't happen to first-time mothers. And secondly, it was really hard. Like, there was no break between the contractions. I remember not being able to get a drink in between them because they were just so thick and fast. But I ended up having a Ventouse, which wasn't really what I wanted, but it was, it was absolutely fine. And I felt respected, listened to. It was a pretty positive birth, particularly for a first-time mum. Mm-hmm. And I walked away from that kind of thinking, I feel a bit sorry for all of the people that were involved in that, particularly the obstetrician who ended up having to do a really difficult instrumental on one of her colleagues. Because I can remember thinking, I wouldn't have wanted to have been you. I think that would be a hard position to be in, to care for somebody that comes to that position from a professional capacity as well.
So you knew all the people that were supporting you when you were giving birth?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my second birth partner is a dear friend who's also a midwife at Southmead, Kelly. So she was not there in a professional capacity. She was there as a supporter, but basically was giving midwifery care. I knew the midwife in the midwife-led unit pretty well. I'd worked with her a lot. I'd actually looked after her when she had a preterm birth. And I knew the obstetrician. I didn't know the anaesthetist, but in the end I didn't end up having an anaesthetist because there wasn't time. But yeah, it felt like a team. And I find it really hard to think about what it must be like for women walking into a hospital not knowing anyone and needing to build rapport and trust those people when you've known them for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like having that relationship with them helped you with that feeling of safety?
Yes, enormously. And also things like transition was really hard and I didn't realise that that's what it was. I just apologised a lot, as I've heard many women do before me, and yet still didn't have that insight that that was what was happening. I could hear them, you know, listening in with the dot tone, and I could hear that the heart rate was normal, and I could hear that my blood pressure was normal, and I could hear that my pulse was normal. And on the one hand, I can remember thinking, those are all normal obs. And on the other hand, I can remember thinking, I'm clearly dying here. How are the obs normal? If you're in transition, you're not dying. That's adrenaline. So having this kind of dual conversation going on in my head, which is very much the conversation between higher brain function, trying to employ your prefrontal cortex about sophisticated decision making. Side note, that part of your brain doesn't work very well in labour.
Usually with good reason, that's exactly what it's supposed to do, but when you're so confident in that area, usually how hard and what a shock that must be.
Yeah and then being a bit shocked by how just animalistic the process feels when you're not normally that person. You're not somebody that lives in their body very much. You're somebody who lives in their brain and does quite an intellectual job. And don't get me wrong, in obstetrics it is a physical job. I use my hands a lot to solve problems and to help diagnosis, but I very much feel like this is me, not the whole thing. And birth, I think, really grounds you in the fact that you are also subject very much to your biology.
Yeah.
And did this affect when you returned to work? Did your birth experience affect how you then practiced?
Yeah, I think the birth experience did, and also a lot of early motherhood did. I had a difficult time getting breastfeeding started. And I just never appreciated how emotional that journey is. That will seem really obvious to people who've been through it and possibly not really resonate with people who've not watched somebody go through that or experienced it themselves. But it just felt like it was something that mattered a lot, and I couldn't really articulate how much until I went through it and thought I would almost have sacrificed anything for that to work. And I can remember when I did paediatrics pre-babies with people who came into hospital who had babies that weren't gaining weight, that were really dehydrated, and they were really crushed about breastfeeding not working. And I could sort of observe that this really mattered to them, and I wanted to help them because it really mattered to them, but I didn't feel it.
Mm. I feel it's a bit like the primal instinct, like what you were saying when you're in labour and that other bit of the brain and the body take over, that's not just the intellectual. I feel like it's the same part of the body that takes over with that urge and need and to feed your child.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely more primal instinct, and until you've experienced it, you can't really feel how overwhelming that is.
Yeah, and I do also want to say that I have... The flip side of that is that I have had two birth experiences and a pregnancy that didn't go to term that we could talk about in a bit if you want to. And those are the only bits that I've been through. So I've never had a cesarean, I've never had a preterm birth, I've never had preeclampsia. There are still loads of things that I'm going to see at work that are not anything that I know how that might feel. Mm-hmm. And I hesitate to ever use the expression "I know how that feels," because actually you know how that felt to you.
Yeah, 100%.
And I have on occasion seen people who've had particular birth experiences try and shape what happens to somebody else on the basis of what they needed. Very occasionally, for instance, people trying to persuade somebody that they don't need an epidural because they themselves didn't need an epidural. It's not okay. And I wonder, and actually do observe sometimes, either colleagues who don't have children, women or men, really trying to empathise harder because they know that they don't know how that feels and they go the extra mile to do so. So I think having had kids does change you as a clinician, but it doesn't necessarily make you better.
Yeah, you almost need to still keep your personal experience to one side so you don't muddy the waters when you're dealing with someone else's experience. We actually talk a lot about that just in our capacity as pregnancy yoga and birth preparation teachers. You know, we talk about in our training how we have to like empty the bowl, as it were, of our own experience so we can hold the space neutrally so people can make their own informed decisions.
Oh, you're so right. And I think if something really emotive has happened to you recently, that's very difficult to do.
So my question, Vicky, would be, and I think I probably know the answer, but I'd love to hear you speak about it. Having had various birthing experiences and worked with lots of other colleagues who've had their own experiences, what kind of structures in place for you and your teammates to kind of debrief, let go of stuff that's happened to you so you can, you know, have support so that you can then deal with the next woman coming through as a clean sheet?
So it's called emotional housekeeping in general practice, where if you're consulting every 7 minutes, you need to be able to do that. There are not formal structures in place for lots of specialties for everyday interactions. Interestingly, in psychiatry there's the practice of something called Balint Group, which is about reflecting on your clinical experiences, what you brought to that transference and counter-transference, which are psychotherapeutic models of how you interact with individuals. I get some of that training through my psychosexual training, and that's mm-hmm. really helped me in those sorts of, not necessarily heated, but emotive discussions, to take a helicopter view and to work out a bit more about why somebody is making me feel a certain way and why it's making me react in a certain way. Mm. But that is not a common medical training, and you sort of have to seek that out a bit. However, for what you would deem more traumatic experiences, so For instance, I was involved in a situation a few years ago where somebody had a massive hemorrhage and they did survive, but it took a lot of work and there were moments where I thought they might not. We were offered something called TRIM, which is a trauma-informed kind of post-event management, which is supported by the hospital. I think it's through occupational health. Because there is something called secondary victim status, where you might not have been injured yourself, but being involved in that, and we, unsurprisingly, loads of people have had that in caring for people in COVID, you end up potentially with PTSD in clinicians. And there was some evidence that emerged in about 2020 that actually showed that lots of obstetricians have left the job because of defined high stress moments where they've either lost someone or nearly lost someone, and they just don't ever want to revisit it again. And I think This Is Going to Hurt did a good job of showing how intrusive lots of those thoughts can be after interactions like that.
And it's interesting that it's there for what's deemed the more traumatic experiences. But what we are observing in the birth world is that there's lots of people that will talk about their birth experience as traumatic, but it might not have ended up being a life-threatening situation, maybe from a clinician's point of view, but for that woman's own internal experience, like you were saying, with when you were having transition, you thought you were going to die. So somebody having a in inverted commas regular birth experience still might feel utterly traumatized by that experience. So maybe the people supporting them do too, and maybe the support around trauma and informed management needs to extend out beyond the red flag moments into a sort of everyday practice.
So there is a practice called trauma-informed care, and there's a really lovely written information kind of handbook for clinicians from Blackpool Better Start that I think does a really good job of explaining to clinicians why somebody's story up until the moment that you meet them really shapes how they perceive things that happen in birth. And when I worked in the perinatal mental health clinic at St Michael's, they did a really good job of doing something called birth planning. So around 32 weeks, you would talk through, so a large number of the women in that clinic had a trauma history. You would talk through what we could do and what we could avoid doing that was going to make that experience better for that woman. So for instance, if they've had an unwanted sexual experience in the past where somebody used particular language, you can avoid doing that. And you can avoid, you know, using particular expressions or a particular room where somebody's had a bad birth experience in the past, like just things that are going to put, you know, give individualized care to that person that means that they feel listened to and that they know that they're not going to be re-traumatized by their birth experience. And I'm really passionate about rolling that out sort of everywhere that I work, because actually, if you go digging for it, loads of people have a trauma history. But you're so right that you can look through the pink birth notes of somebody who's had, in quotes, a normal birth, whatever that is, and it doesn't look classically traumatic. And I think certainly when I started training, people expected a traumatic birth to look like a 2.5 litre hemorrhage and not having enough pain relief and that kind of stuff. But actually, if somebody's internal monologue is that they're completely spinning out of control, it doesn't really matter what happened physically if they didn't feel listened to.
100%.
And we can do better. And actually, that doesn't require money. It requires just understanding and potentially a culture shift.
Yeah, how does that happen? You know, the power of language, the power of, you know, listening to people. Yeah, in such a huge organisation, when it's something that might not require everyone to trot off and do a course, but it's about listening, it's about using first names, and, you know, especially when we're talking about women that are giving birth, they're not really patients in a historical sense, they're not really ill, their people, their clients that have that are having a baby. So how does language shift and culture shift within something huge like the NHS?
I've definitely seen changes in the 10 years that I've been in obstetrics. So that's really encouraging. And I think what we have to remember is that the way that lots of people pick up on language online is often not helpful, and is really censorious and, you know, basically cancel culture and saying you can't say that because it's offensive. It's not how you solve a problem, is it? You mm-hmm. just gently suggest that we could maybe use a different expression. It's really, really helpful to persuade clinicians when you have evidence that it's not helpful. So, for instance, I also do a lot of early pregnancy stuff. About 10 years ago, the Miscarriage Association, combined with Mumsnet, did lots of patient involvement work about what they wanted to call the operation that you have to help with a miscarriage. And they decided that they wanted to call it surgical management of miscarriage. And that is basically something that was introduced in 2012. We've all been encouraged to call it that. Similarly, there are words around birth that I think could do with changing. So in the past, the experience of somebody going into preterm labour or having a second trimester loss where they experienced no pain, weren't aware it was happening, they just, for instance, had some pinky loss and then very sadly went on to lose the baby, used to be called cervical incompetence.
One of my worst phrases ever, along with geriatric mother.
So that is now much more commonly called cervical insufficiency, which I think is less judgy.
Still a bit rough though.
It's not great, but I think that what they're trying to describe is that for whatever reason the cervix isn't holding the pregnancy in. It's better, it's not perfect. Similarly, failure to progress, I don't love. I'd rather call it delay in first or second stage, depending on when it happens. It's just the descriptor. There will always be some resistance to changing that stuff because I'm not sure that everyone minds, firstly, if those words are used. But if there is good evidence that we can show that people do mind, then we need to change it.
It's also from the woman's point of view. I'm in lots of sort of birth trauma groups online, and when asking women about their experiences, it seems to be when the people supporting them, the professionals supporting them, use phrases like, well, we'll let you go this far and then we're going to do this. Or, well, you're not allowed to do this, so I'm going to call it and then we're going to do that. So the actual decision-making component, even if there isn't really a decision, hasn't been discussed and she hasn't felt like she's been empowered with that. So how do we sort of shift that? Because that's quite a biggie, and that's the one that I hear quite a lot from people in their birth stories.
I think people use language without necessarily intending to convey a patriarchal viewpoint. So words like allow are and they just set up an adult child dynamic, don't they?
Yeah,
that person's about to become a parent, probably infantilizing them isn't very helpful. Loads and loads of our job is about sensitively conveying risk, and I would much rather say I'm afraid I really don't feel like we can support such and such if somebody's going to do something which I think is really medically inadvisable, rather than saying I won't allow it, which makes you feel like you're a gatekeeper to something that you're not a gatekeeper to.
100%. That's really, really well said, Vicky. Thank you.
You often have people going against your advice, or is that quite a rarity, and how do you manage that?
So I wouldn't say often, and I think interestingly it depends on your clientele, because it happens definitely much more often in some hospitals than others. I think it is I had a woman the other day who, for instance, had a quite high risk of getting a blood clot in pregnancy. And the guidelines, which are guidelines, not protocols or tram lines, but the guidelines, recommended that she would have low molecular weight heparin, so heparin injections from 28 weeks pregnant to try and reduce that happening. Now, the vast majority of people would take it as, you know, they don't want to do any further investigation. I would say your risk, according to the RCOG scoring, is this. Therefore, they would recommend this. Here's your prescription. Off you go. This lady, fair play to her, said, right, what's my risk of blood clots? What's the risk go down to if I have this medication? What are all of my risk factors? How much do they increase my risk? What can I change? And she went through it. She went through the stats and she worked out in, you know, numbers per 100,000. That's the amount of detail she wanted. I got all of the guidelines up. I showed her all of the numbers. Now, interestingly, I feel like 5 to 10 years ago, I would have found that encounter quite threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And I know why I would have found it quite threatening, because I'm now able to articulate it through having done psychosexual medicine, is that potentially that interaction like de-doctors you. It makes you feel like you're not the authority. I'm not the authority. I just know where the information is. She's the person who ultimately gets to decide the level of risk that she's happy to encounter.
Mm-hmm.
I have to counsel her that that's what we would medically recommend, but it's not a personal slight if she doesn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, she decided she did want to take the low molecular weight heparin, but that was the most informed of informed decision making I've seen for a while, and it actually felt great. I mean,
amazing.
But it, like, I knew where the information was. That is my job. And she came away from that, I think, feeling like somebody was willing to give that information to her.
Very empowered.
It's really like, because often there sometimes feels like there's this division or like you're opposing forces. And actually that's not the case. You know, your whole job is about supporting and helping women to have the best experience they can have and helping them to make informed decisions. So to see that working way, you know, you really get to be in that element of giving her all the information and you know, shining on what you do so well of presenting that to her and then allowing her to be the one that is in charge, that is the decision maker. It, you know, it sounded like a real kind of team effort in the best kind of way. And I would love to think there's more people out there that could see it that way and could work that way.
I think what we have to remember, and I did make reference to it, though, is that it takes time. It takes time. And I went to a recent medico-legal course about obstetrics, which is really important because you will get sued as an obstetrician at some point. It's just, you know, a fact of life. And they talked about, there are some guidelines from NICE in 2021 about shared decision-making. Two things. One is that if you follow those guidelines to the letter, each one of your consultations is going to take more than half an hour. We don't have half an hour per patient. We've got about 20 minutes per patient in antenatal clinic. So firstly, there is a mismatch there between what we're able to offer and what is expected of us. And also on the medico-legal study day, they pointed out that those NICE guidelines about shared decision-making do not pertain to emergency decision-making. So they can't really guide you about what you should be doing in the moment, you know, in the birth room.
So who gets the final say in an emergency decision-making situation? If the woman's compos mentis, where does the buck lie?
Oh, it stops with her. If she says, you're not allowed to examine me, even if the fetal heart rate is 60, I can't examine her and I won't.
I imagine that in those emergency scenarios there would be very few people that are not, if they're feeling unsafe or that things are really at risk, then they're gonna really be looking to you as the expert in that scenario to guide them, I imagine, most of the time. Does it often happen that in an emergency scenario there's disagreement about how to proceed?
I haven't had very many encounters. I've had a few people who've had extremely rigid, and I would call them not even birth preferences, birth plans, this is how it's going to go. who have declined lots of intervention, even in the face of quite compelling medical evidence that things aren't going well. That's really difficult to manage, because ultimately my first priority is to the woman. But equally, if she gives birth to a baby that has been damaged by that birth and I didn't intervene in time, or I didn't offer intervention with an appropriate strength of recommendation, then I've done that woman a disservice, and she will have to live with the consequences of that for the rest of her life. So the problem is, if somebody really, really, really doesn't want any intervention at all, and for instance, the baby's heart rate is really abnormal, I need to try to understand how she's come to this place, that she doesn't want any intervention at all, and she believes that I'm not necessarily there for her well-being, because often there's a mistrust there, and I need to serve her baby. And that can be, those are kind of, there's a lot of internal turmoil as a clinician when you're doing that, because you have to be calm and you have to maintain rapport. But equally, you know that that woman's ideal birth does not involve you being in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that loss. Like, I know that if I take somebody to theatre who really wanted a completely uninterrupted birth, that that was not what they wanted. Mm. And I have to be conscious of that.
Yeah. With our work, we've kind of got to a point where we've looked at various pieces of research as well that kind of says that as long as you're participating in the decision-making process as a birthing woman, and you're able, even if it's in 1 minute, to have a conversation where you're able to assess the benefits and the risks and find out if there's any alternatives and listen into your instincts and work out what happens if we did nothing, and you come to a conclusion that your birth could take many different directions and have lots of interventions, and you will feel positive and empowered that it was the best birth for you and your baby, that it's more about the decision making and the participation in it than it is about how it actually unfolds.
Yeah, having agency is just such a key part to looking back on it and feeling like you did the best that you could with the information that you had at the time.
Yeah.
And I think very occasionally I have needed to frame offering an emergency intervention to somebody as the fact that I won't do anything without their consent at all, but they are in the best position to advocate for their baby. And if they're advocating for their baby, this would be what I would recommend. But I won't, you know, I'm just offering information and I won't do anything at all without their permission. And you've usually got at least 1 or 2 minutes for them to be able to decide. There are very few circumstances where that's not going to be the case.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that 1 or 2 minutes and for them to decide is really important for how they then look back at that whole experience afterwards. I've got some really curious questions bubbling in the back of my head if we kind of track some of these experiences back, and I'm kind of thinking to some of the other things that I'm seeing on social media. You know, I absolutely love Dr. Sarah Wickham's work about induction and informed choice and time and place. And I don't know if you've seen the Naked Midwife or the Naked Doula, and she does all the flashcards and it's super empowering. And of course there's like another huge movement on social media with, you know, about free birthing. So, you know, there's like, it's like a melting pot is where I'm getting to. It's a melting pot of lots of information out there, everyone trying to empower people to have the most positive experiences along the way. So if we were going to talk to someone that was like low risk, really healthy baby, what kind of ports of call would you say would be good places for her to start thinking about her birth preferences, to line up the stats to maybe help her have the most positive, empowering experience possible? Is there any kind of tips we could send that way?
Like where I would go with that. So there's a website called Evidence Based Birth, and Sarah Wickham has lots of information. Also the Royal College of Obs and Gynae like has got a lot of useful information. For instance, the instrumental birth guideline or assisted birth guideline has got information in there about how to reduce your chances of needing an instrumental birth. And I think that that's such a good place to start, that it's not just a how-to guide for obstetricians about how and when to do it, but also about ways to encourage women to not need intervention at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably recommend a melting pot of various patient information leaflets off the Royal College of Obs and Gynae website, evidence-based birth. There's also somebody else who does a series of she does a hypnobirthing course called the Bumped Baby Chapter, who's a midwife called Beth, who's got some really good information that she's put together. I'm biased because she's just asked me to do a load of obstetric videos for her. So. So I wouldn't go to just one place. And I think that's one of the other things that we have to remember about how we critique scientific information, is that if you only look to one person, you will often get a personal slant on a scientific issue. And whilst attitudinally you may completely align with that person that's writing that website, I think it is a good idea to cast your net a little wider and think about, you know, what their motivations are for forming that website or writing that information, and also looking at, emerging work. Another place that I would look, the Tommy's website. The Tommy's website is excellent. It is not just excellent for things that can go wrong, but also for emotional care. I've been really impressed by the fact that around pregnancy loss, for instance, they have a section advising you on how to change your social media settings so that you do not get loads of unwanted stuff about having a baby coming up, which can be really traumatic in the face of recent pregnancy loss. And I just thought, that's holistic care in the modern age that you won't get from most hospitals, actually. They've really thought about the experience of that person when they go home and have to face the world after what's happened in hospital.
That's all really brilliant signposting. Thank you. And you did mention actually earlier on that sometimes, you know, to avoid interventions, it's to, a main thing is to do with the biomechanics.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people doing biomechanic kind of workshops at the moment. And I guess spinning babies was one of the original places, you know, getting into all these different positions. And we do a lot of that kind of stuff in our pregnancy yoga. But are there some kind of key moves that you would recommend people to have a go at to help with the biomechanics?
So they had a recent biomechanics lecture and workshop in Great Western Hospital. And I'm really glad to see that when there is good evidence for that kind of thing, that that hospital in particular is getting on board with it. So they've got the peanut balls, that like they're happy to take into account, for instance, evidence from the bumps trial, which means if you've got an epidural in, that actually you can shorten second stage of labor by lying on your left hand side. We'd always thought that sitting upright was the way to go, but potentially that's not the case. There are things like side lying release, which you don't do yourself, it's usually somebody helps you to do it, that seem to have some evidence behind them. So I'm not trained in biomechanics, but essentially I'm really open to midwifery practices that are, and I would like to get some training in that, because it makes perfect sense that the pelvis is a dynamic structure, and that actually if birth is a dynamic process with natural reflexes of how the baby rotates through the pelvis, hits the pelvic floor, you know, all of those pushing reflexes that we get at various stages, that actually if you can be responsive to that and use that knowledge to help somebody get an easier birth, why would you not do it? Like, it doesn't have to be a drug, it doesn't have to be an instrument. If we know that just positioning, which is going to be free for a start, always an easy sell in the NHS, why would we not do that stuff?
Did you do any, other than coming to my pregnancy yoga classes, did you do any of that kind of preparation on the lead up to either of your births?
I tried to do lots of kind of upright, forward and open stuff towards the end of the pregnancy. So I never kind of lay back on the sofa. But I don't know how much evidence there really is that that's one of the reasons why we see OP babies at the beginning of labour. I mean, I knew from the get-go that the position that my baby was in was because of how I slept most often. So he was slightly to the right and the back was always to my belly, which is a good position to go into labour in. I also made quite a lot of use of the birth ball in early labour. And then, yeah, so, I mean, second time around, as soon as I got to hospital, I got straight into the pool. So
you didn't have a precipitous labour the second time then?
No, it was really different. So it's just very interesting how your body doesn't really let you labour properly until it's safe to do so. Exactly the same timing, 8 days past my due date, woke up that morning. So last time round, I'd had a baby at 4:30 in the morning, 8 days past my due date. So when I woke up at 7 a.m, I was like, this is the most pregnant I've ever been, and I'm absolutely enormous, and I'm really over it. It was approaching Christmas. I had to look after my then 3-year-old son, and I decided we would drive to the supermarket, get some ready roll pastry and some mincemeat, and we would make some mince pies together. And I remember walking round Waitrose with him and occasionally, like probably once an aisle, having to lean over the trolley and breathe through some Braxton Hicks. They weren't Braxton Hicks. And my mum had volunteered to come over that day to help look after my son because he's really high energy and I had terrible pelvic pain and I couldn't really keep up with him and he needed, you know, walking like a dog. And we got in the car, came back, made some mince pies with intermittent contractions. And then my mum rang and said, oh, I'm going to be a bit later than expected. I'm only just setting off now. And I hadn't really realised what was going on until I answered her really snappily, I'm not sure I can wait till then. She arrived. And I was sort of making use of anything I could lean over, kitchen surface, back of a chair, the stairs, the yoga ball, occasionally my son's head. trying to watch some David Attenborough documentaries with him because he's like obsessed with nature. Every time I had a contraction, he would ask me a question that I couldn't answer. But things carried on contracting. About 1 in 10, and I tried to ring my husband several times during that time. He was working in a secure psychiatric unit, so he didn't have his mobile on him. Rang him all afternoon, no answer. And then I finally remembered he'd given me a landline number, by which time my mum's saying, I think I need to drive you to the hospital, these are getting closer together. I had instructions on the fridge of what to do in the case of an accidental home birth, because things had been so quick last time round. So there were all the numbers, Kelly Hamilton, my mate down the road, paediatrician half a mile up the road, anaesthetist up the road. But you know, it wasn't really a plan I wanted to have to use. Finally, I got through to Jonathan, who said, oh yeah, I'm on my way home. And then as soon as he got home and we got straight in the car, the contractions came thick and fast. And it's basically like you suddenly go, it's fine, I'm going to get there. The plan has come together. It's all safe now. And then I got to Bath and was 8 centimetres. Got in the pool. No further progress. A couple of hours later, and was happy for them to break my waters. And I knew that time, as soon as they broke my waters, things were about to become quite uncivilised because, you know, you're a multip and you're close. And it was loads better because even though I had that overwhelming feeling of them being really, really intense, I knew that that was transition. And knowing that that was transition and having that insight felt just so much safer than how it had felt the first time around when it felt wild.
Oh, so did your baby get born in the pool?
He did. I was I was probably a slightly tricky customer. So I was having intermittent auscultation. I was definitely a tricky customer. I was having
intermittent... Because you know too much, Vicky.
I was having intermittent auscultation. They listened in. The fetal heart rate was really high. I knew I didn't have a temperature. My heart rate was fine. In fact, my heart rate was 100, but I'd been quite tachycardic throughout the pregnancy because he was enormous and I was breathless. So at least we knew that that was what my baseline was. So they asked me to get out of the pool to have a CTG. And I said, no, I'll have a CTG in the pool with the wireless telemetry, thanks. And Evie, my lovely midwife, was like, yeah, fine, of course you will.
Small eye roll.
She went off very much, you know, like conspiratorial. Like it was, yeah. And so she went to go and get the wireless telemetry, and she had the machine out of the pool room because it works within 5 or 10 meters or something. So I didn't need to see it. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to be trying to make those sorts of decisions.
That's so cool that it can be that far away. I love that. I didn't know that.
I mean, it makes it difficult if you're a single midwife in the room, both trying to tend physically to the woman and interpret the trace if they are that distant. But it, you know, it means that people can like get up and go to the loo and stuff without having to take it off. Mm-hmm. And actually, it just showed that the trace was fine. In fact, it was very accelerative, which is encouraging. So baby was moving, heart rate was going up, it was coming back down to a baseline. But you couldn't interpret that just from listening in for a minute with the dot tone. And I got out anyway, and that's when they broke my waters and the trace continued to be normal. And I said at that point, well, according to NICE guidelines, given that your original indication for doing a CTG has shown half an hour of normal trace and there are no other risks, please can I get back in the pool? And she went, yes. Got back in the pool, and the CTG was stopped. And that's like all totally legit. That is like how the guidelines say that you can offer that care. So I got back into the pool for transition, which I found really helpful, and had him in the pool. Pushing took a bit longer than I think they were expecting. My husband was aware of the fantastic coordinating midwife who I also really wanted to be involved, kind of talking quietly in the corner of the room with the primary midwife, which I think was, she's been pushing for half an hour. Why is there no baby yet? This is a second baby. She's pushing really well. When he emerged and he was 4.7 kilos, that was why it had taken 40 minutes to push him out. But I think...
Did you catch him in the water yourself?
Yeah, I pulled him out.
And
then had after pains that were definitely worse than the birth. but yeah, it felt... That was a... like an absolutely euphoric experience. If I could bottle how that had felt afterwards, particularly that, like, we had a playlist that I'd been playing for several weeks beforehand, brought in a wireless speaker, and it was just, I sang quite a lot during the contractions. Still using that birth playlist, like, makes me really happy looking back on it. But, you know, that was an eye-opener to know that that's what birth could be like.
Oh, would you have considered doing all of that at home?
Time
round and everything.
It's a good question. I do have a couple of obstetric colleagues who've had home births, and they're extremely sensible people. Like, that, I don't think anyone considers them to be unusual in their clinical practice. They looked at the risks and benefits and decided that was right for them. I was half considering it. My husband really, really didn't want me to. And I think that has to be a large part of the decision making, because if he's going to be my primary support in birth, he has to be on board. And he really didn't want me to. And he was much happier with the setup that we had in Bath, which is where I had the second one, which was that there was a low risk room that firstly doesn't have carpets. and that actually, if it all did go a bit wrong, we were, you know, 5 minutes away from theatre max. And I think you're a team going into that if you're two parents making those decisions together. And I think worst case scenario, if there had been something that had gone wrong, I would have found that very difficult to carry as an individual, knowing that I'd gone against his wishes.
Mm-hmm. And then do you think kind of, you know, looking more globally at the stats around, you know, home birth, you know, the safe place to study, research that happened, you know, that kind of now is in the NICE guidelines saying that home birth and midwife-led units are safest places to give birth if you don't want to have, you know, big interventions.
Yeah.
Culturally, we're kind of not there yet, are we? Like 2% of the country plan home birth, and down here in Brighton, sometimes we get up to 10%, whereas in Holland, it's like loads of people will have home birth. So what would you say we might need to do to kind of shift ourselves culturally to follow the stats and maybe have...
off midwifery properly. So one of the big problems that we have nationally is that we've got loads of midwife-led units which you can't staff safely because there aren't enough midwives, and also staff their higher risk central delivery suite. You cannot close a high risk central delivery suite because it is always needed. You can close the alongside midwife-led birth unit, and that's a real sadness because there's lots and lots of resources have been put into places like Cosham, and, you know, in the Great Western Hospital, the Whitehorse Birth Centre, which are really beautiful places to give birth. But you have to have two midwives available for an individual to be able to safely offer home birth.
But surely you still need two midwives available in a hospital situation too?
So it's not quite the same. If somebody has a baby in, I'm going to put this in just terms that are familiar to me. Somebody has a baby in room 7. She has one-to-one midwifery care up until the moment when the birth is imminent. She calls for a second midwife. The second midwife is on the unit. She is there in 30 seconds. She is there in case there is a problem with the woman, for instance, like bleeding, or a shoulder dystocia, or the baby needs some resuscitation before the paediatricians arrive. But actually, if all goes well, she only needs to be in the room for 15 minutes. She can then attend another birth down the corridor, you know, 5 minutes after that. It's not the same as having...
two at home for several hours.
You see what I mean?
Got it.
Women come to you, you are able to use your resources more efficiently. And by that, I also mean human resources. Then you can if people are going out to all of the women's houses. And there is definitely a conflict there about what I would really like to be able to offer the woman in front of me as though she is the only person in the world that I'm looking after, mm-hmm. versus the tension that you have about how you spread these resources to give the safest possible outcomes.
And then the other side of that little kind of puzzle piece would be, you know, there's a lot of people leaving midwifery, there's a lot of stress in the job, and there's a lot of students struggling to get through the course. You know, it's quite hardcore 3 years. There's like huge, huge fallout. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done on that midwifery side to make that career much more robust and supported and get more midwives in, basically.
Yeah, I think you see this in various areas of medicine where essentially things become understaffed. That means that the care that you are able to offer during that shift doesn't feel like the care that you want to be able to offer. And you don't walk away from that shift feeling rewarded. And I don't mean in a financial sense. I mean that you walk away going, that was absolutely great. They had a great birth. You know, I was a key player in being part of a team that offered exemplary care to that woman. That's what people want to feel when they're at work. And if you are understaffed and you're constantly, you know, giving 70% of the level of care that you would like to be able to offer, it's not rewarding. And those people get burnt out. And one of two things happen. They either leave or you become emotionally defensive, which is what the care looks like in This Is Going to Hurt. That is burnout. And we didn't have a word for it in 2006, which is when that was set. But that's basically what happens when you work people so hard that they don't get to have meaningful connection with the people that they're offering care to. And it is meaningful connection which is the currency of why people want to do their jobs in healthcare.
Mm. Yeah, and that, you know, that good old bedside manner, it actually goes an awful long way, doesn't it?
And it, I mean, it makes people feel safer, it makes people trust their clinicians, but also looking at it from the clinician's point of view, it makes that job worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fascinating, Vicky. Thank you.
How did you find This Is Going to Hurt?
Oh, really mixed bag. I found my house jobs really quite hard, and they didn't involve obstetrics. But in my first year post-qualification, I really wondered whether or not I was going to leave medicine. I lost 25 kilos, partly through constant anxiety and having no appetite, and partly through having absolutely no time to eat. I was in early and left late basically every day. I had a really misplaced sense of responsibility that if a patient didn't do well, that was on me as a doctor qualified for, you know, 3 or 6 months. There was a great physical and emotional distance between me and my seniors. I just thought I was terrible at my job. And a large part of that was exhaustion as well. But also, I became aware later on that if you are somebody who's good at exams and therefore people recommend that you go and do things like medicine because you're good at exams, you thrive on external validation. You like the big red ticks in the margin. You like getting an A. That's what you thrive off, and you're only as good as your last success. That is not what frontline medicine looks like. If you can't get a cannula into somebody 5 or 6 times and it's hurting them, that's a horrible experience actually for both of you. It's really horrible for the patient. It also makes you feel crushed and like you're not very good at your job. And so you kind of have to reframe your working day in how you can reward yourself. And I don't really think medical school at that time adequately prepared me for the fact that that's what my working day might look like. And when you see Adam being cold and flippant with people in This Is Going to Hurt, I don't think that that is so much a reflection on particularly obstetrics. I think that is just a reflection of clinician burnout, and it could have been in any specialty. And it's particularly horrifying because it involved mothers and their babies, but it should have been just as horrifying if it was in care of the elderly or a respiratory ward, because that is somebody who just doesn't have capacity to feel anymore.
For me, watching it, I felt everything, talking about feeling safe, watching that program didn't make me feel safe. It looked like everything was just on the brink of just about getting by, as opposed to confidently with enough resources, everything doing as it should.
The roof literally falls down in one episode. It's like, literally, it's falling apart.
There's all sorts of moments where you wonder, could that really happen? Is that real? And there's so many. It's like, it's not just from one perspective, is it? And you see all these other stories overplaying all the different characters and their perspective of what's going on. And I found it really interesting. I watched the whole of the series, and I don't think a lot of people did make it through the whole of the series. And I know that there was a real, even before it came out, because of the book, there was a real pushback against it because people felt it was misogynistic, or that they were trying to make humour out of people's experiences, taking away their dignity and so on. I actually just found it really fascinating how, you know, it's real life. People have to find a way to cope, to do the job in whatever form that is.
This is exactly it. And I dislike a lot of the language that he uses about women, and it is flippant and at the very least unhelpful. But I think so I didn't train with him. I've never worked with Adam Kay, but I actually have quite a few colleagues who did. And they said that he got a standing ovation at a conference when he gave a talk about burnout and lack of support from seniors. I think he had been trying to kind of ring the alarm about the fact that that was what was happening within some of the organisations where he worked and was not listened to. And basically that book was him flying the red flag and going, this has to stop, actually. It was a way of him decompressing and alerting people to the fact that that's what medical systems were looking like. I think I personally don't feel he's a misogynist. I feel that he would have made gallows humour out of whatever area of medicine he was in, and that happened to be obstetrics. It feels really disrespectful from where I'm standing, but I just think that he was, as you say, he was finding a way to cope.
And trying to wave the alarm, ring the alarm bell.
Yeah.
There was a piece in it towards the end, I don't know if you got to this episode, Vicky, where he's on call in a private hospital where the mother-to-be spent, I don't know, 20 or 40 grand to have her baby there. And then as soon as something goes wrong, she has to be sent back into the NHS. And there was a little line at the end of that little sequence where one of the staff on the ward kind of rolls her eyes and is like, well, if only we could get some of that money that they've paid to that private hospital, it would change the game around here. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to show, that actually the NHS has to step in and save the day, and they don't get remunerated for it. And these private hospitals are scooping up thousands and thousands of pounds and they're providing nice risotto. Like, what is going on there?
And carpeted rooms, which I'm not sure I want in a hospital. So you make a really good point. I think there have been isolated incidents of potentially celebrities being cared for in private units, which are physically separate from acute hospitals, and then when it's all gone horribly wrong, they've had to come to the NHS for further care. Actually, private obstetrics is not really a thing outside of London. And so I'm not touched by it in practice in and around Bristol, Gloucester, Swindon, Bath. There are, I'm sure, tales that could be told about people having babies in London and then being blue lighted across to NHS hospitals. But I don't have any personal experience of that. So I think I would hesitate to form a judgment about it.
Oh, that's all really interesting to know. Did you watch any of, have you seen any of the Yorkshire Midwives? Yeah, as a total counterpart.
I haven't, but I've seen many a blog post celebrating what a tonic is. So my understanding is that it's a Sheffield group of midwives.
Bradford.
And they have a continuity of care model, and there's a relatively high home birth rate, and it looks like everybody's very fulfilled by their jobs. And, you know, if only it could be like that everywhere. I mean, I haven't interrogated lots of their stats, because always when I'm shown really high home birth rates and very fulfilled midwives, I would also want to look at things like NICU admission rates. Not because I'm a massive cynic, but because I think you have to look at the whole picture. But I think, you know, if you risk assess appropriately, you can offer those services. You just need to be appropriately resourced. And, you know, if we haven't got enough midwives to staff, then we can't offer them safely. And that's heartbreaking.
Absolutely. What would you like mums to be to know?
I think one of the things that I've been really encouraged by recently, actually, is the formation of these ideas of perinatal teams. And I feel like lots of women think about the birth, but then the bit afterwards, that fourth trimester, can feel intellectually quite disconnected. And I think they're very, very related. So a positive birth can feed into a much more positive fourth trimester. Actually, lots of that team thinking, I'm really encouraged, for instance, in Swindon, where when we have a preterm baby coming, the obstetricians plan with the paediatricians how we're going to get that baby across the divide from uterus into the outside world in the safest way, with the gentlest cardiovascular transitions, with deferred cord clamping, with the paediatrician scrubbed, and that kind of, you know, journey from inside to outside, becomes as cohesive and holistic as possible. And I would encourage women to think about their birth, not just about the birth, but about the time afterwards, because it kind of all fits together. And similarly, building your supporters, people think about birth supporters, but who's going to support you in those first 2 to 4 weeks when you go home? If you don't have a particularly helpful family, might you consider a postnatal doula, that kind of thing? I had a postnatal doula second time around. Amazing. I think it kind of sets you on the right path of having your head in the right place.
More support. Takes a village.
Yeah, it takes a village, but not just for the actual baby coming out, but for the, you know, the weeks afterwards.
For the next 18 years.
Do you, you reminded me of something now I meant to ask you, is have you performed a gentle cesarean or a woman-centred cesarean? Have you seen that happening or perform one yourself?
So I would say that all of the cesareans that I do try to be as gentle as possible. So even in a, I hate this expression, crash section, unnecessarily dramatic language, baby needs to come out quite quickly. You can get down to the uterus quite quickly. The baby does not need to be fired out. Like, you can still deliver the baby with some time. And the bit of the baby emerging from the uterus can still take, you know, 30 seconds with some good stimulation with the cord intact in most cases. But it has been commented upon that I deliver the baby really slowly when I do a cesarean, because actually, particularly if that's a non-labouring cesarean section, that baby's not had a heads up physiologically at all that they're about to be born. And so if you give them a bit of a squeeze on the way out, if this doesn't always work, but you can sometimes open the uterus and deliver the head and shoulders, and then actually, if you give the uterus a rub, you can sometimes stimulate a contraction that will kind of auto-deliver the baby. I love it when that works. It doesn't always work. Either you can't get a contraction to happen, or if it's not a first cesarean, sometimes the scar tissue is too restrictive and the baby won't come out with a bit, you know, without a bit more help. But it's really nice to be able to do that. And sometimes partners will video that moment of emergence. We don't, in any of the hospitals I've worked in, have see-through drapes, and I don't think lots of women would want them. But it would be nice to be able to offer, maybe, for the women that did. And in some hospitals, I've been able to negotiate being able to pass the baby straight over the drape. And then if I can, without desterilising myself, get the partner to clamp the cord and cut, that's lovely to be able to do. That is not safely written within the policy of lots of hospitals, and I think you would have to be able to show that there's no increase in your infection rates if you do that. So you kind of have to think carefully about doing it. But I've been encouraged where I am at the moment that if I can write a gentle cesarean policy incorporating some of those things, they would be happy to support me in doing that. But it's not in place currently where I work, to be able to pass the baby straight over the drape.
Wow. I think that would be really quite popular for some women, having their cesarean. Obviously the lights are really bright, and sometimes, you know, you've got those goggles on, so actually, even if they can't look over the drape, there's that opportunity to look into the obstetrician's goggles and see the reflection of what's going on. That might be something they want to do or not do.
Yeah, you know, people have their own preferences. Like, I always ask if somebody wants their music on, and how much they want to see. But some people don't want that. Like, some people do not want to be, you know, in the moment of a baby emerging from their belly for whatever reason.
Yeah.
You can still really encourage skin to skin afterwards and not extraneous chatting about what you're planning doing next on the ward, which is probably not what they need to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about sensitivity and compassionate, and trying to individualise that care as much as you can in the moment.
And you can still very much do that without necessarily showing them everything or passing the baby over the drape, just going with, you know, what is important to them.
And while we've got you, I've got a bit of a completely random question before we wrap up, because I'm pretty aware we're chatting for a long, long time. Read a lovely article a little while ago about artificial wombs and, you know, the future of, you know, the sci-fi end of obstetrics.
Oh, yeah.
Any opinions on that, Vicky? Are we there yet? Is it going to happen?
We've definitely had first uterine transplant, and I think they've had a successful pregnancy and a uterine transplant. There is a group of women who don't have a uterus for a variety of reasons, either because they have inborn conditions like something called Rokitansky syndrome, where you have ovaries but you don't have a uterus, or for instance, somebody who's had cervical cancer and had to have their uterus removed but might, for instance, have had eggs frozen, where they're looking for alternatives, and they're becoming more and more promising as the years go on. So for instance, in Oxford, they came to us in St Michael's for a number of young women undergoing cancer treatment that where they knew that the chemo is likely to cause infertility. So we were doing an elective operation at the beginning of the chemo cycle to remove an ovary, which will then be immediately frozen and basically kept on ice. And then if that woman chooses in the future, you can re-implant that ovary and potentially get it to start ovulating again.
Wow.
Now, that absolutely doesn't have an 100% success rate, but as the culture techniques, the freezing techniques, the reimplantation techniques become more sophisticated, that success rate is only going to go up. And aside from which, I think it's just so important for somebody at the beginning of a life-threatening illness, having treatment like chemo, that the idea that somebody is thinking forward to your later adulthood with a view to fertility and not just your survival, I think offers a real hope that we're not just expecting you to survive, we're expecting you to survive and have reproductive choices in the future.
That's a very positive way of entering that difficult scenario. We have a few questions that we like to ask all our guests. One is our little version of the guilty feminist, I'm a feminist, but we say I'm a yoga teacher, but, and follow it up with something that you wouldn't expect of a yoga teacher. So it's kind of getting rid of any assumptions people might have or taking some of the mystery out of what it means to be a yoga teacher. Wondering, is there anything that people might not know about you or might not expect from a doctor?
I am an obstetrician, but I absolutely love a birth story that doesn't involve any doctors. Is that terrible?
That's fabulous.
Ultimately, one of the things I really thrive on in this job is that I think that women are incredible. And I just, you know, quite like reading about women that are being incredible without me. And that, you know, that doesn't mean I'm anti my job or anti intervention, but I just love seeing how things work out sometimes in an uninterrupted way. And I feel like our job, when done well, often learns from how things happen physiologically. And so, you know, being around physiological birth a lot should inform our practice as obstetricians. I just like to see how it works when we just observe.
Do many of your colleagues ever get to see that?
If ever there's a quiet moment at work, I try and send as many of the SHOs in to just be around, a vaginal birth that's happening in a room that doesn't need a doctor in there. I'll just say, go in and be second midwife, you know, prep the resuscitator, do whatever's needed, take whatever drugs are needed, but just basically go in there and see how it happens. Firstly, you've got loads to learn from midwives. Loads about how to support women, how to position women, how to, you know, help support a perineum, how to bring a baby up onto a chest, how to encourage the woman to bring her hands down to bring the baby up onto her chest for her to feel really connected with that. These are all things that we can use to inform our practice in, for instance, assisted birth. But also, it's just something a bit magical about it.
It is.
Totally magical.
It really is.
I'm moment in between when, like, I love that moment as a doula when kind of the head's out but the baby's still in and they're doing their little turning around thing and they might be opening their eyes and blowing bubbles. Yeah, blowing bubbles. But they're not actually breathing air yet until they come all the way out and take their first gasp. And for that kind of 2-3 minutes, the room is silent and something incredibly magical and sacred about it, for sure.
Well, our other question is, we believe that each baby brings a gift with it. So maybe a personality trait you didn't have before, or a new perspective, or a new quality to yourself, if you like. Do you agree? And what do you think your baby's brought you?
I think Freddie brought me humility. Freddie was my first baby, is my first baby. I went from working full-time as an obstetrician and having a degree of professional confidence that I think gave me a misplaced sense of how much control I had in the world. So I was a pretty competent obstetrician by the time I went off on maternity leave. I could handle lots of emergencies. If I said we needed to go for a Cat 1 section, an entire team of people jumped to do what I'd said. And that, I didn't mean that in a kind of egotistical way, although perhaps on some level I did. And then this baby came into the world who, excuse my French, didn't give a shit what I thought. I didn't understand him. I didn't know what he needed. I didn't know. And it just really knocked the stuffing out of me. And I think rebuilt me from the ground up. And that process of matrescence, which is my favourite new word, was really hard. But I think just was a big teacher. The second pregnancy, which didn't go to term, which was a little girl who had Patau syndrome, April, I think taught me that we're not just doctors, we're people too. And I'd always protected myself psychologically by thinking that groups of people that bad things happen to are somehow other. If you're, you know, you won't be touched by that because they're a patient and you're not a patient, you're a doctor, but then actually you cross that divide and you're on the other side of this unseen glass where actually you become a member of the worst club in the world. And suddenly I was really vulnerable. And actually that was really, really hard, but I think has informed being a clinician afterwards. And then Kit basically kind of was incredibly healing. So Kit's the youngest, who is this like unexpected birth of an absolutely giant baby. It was euphoric and I felt like an enormous sense of confidence and well-being afterwards, which really felt like he gave me something back. And I feel like really, really lucky to have had that experience, because for lots of people who have sad obstetric histories, they don't necessarily get to bookend that with something healing, like either because their fertility isn't there for them anymore or because a relationship breaks down and they don't have the option of further pregnancies. I'm so, so lucky to have, you know, finished my family on a really, really positive experience.
Oh.
That's incredible. Vicky. Thank you. You described that so beautifully. And our last little question is, what are you grateful for in your life right now? And it could be absolutely anything.
So the adult family members. So basically this week I am running from pillar to post. I'm working nights on my son's birthday. I am really busy. I went out and rehearsed with Bristol Symphony Orchestra last night, and my husband enabled me to go out and rehearse by coming home from his on-call and looking after the kids. My mum is going to come over and look after Kit on Thursday when I should be awake, but I'm not going to be because I'm on nights. And my dad is currently doing a thing where he cooks a curry for us once a week, which, like, just not having to think about what we cook once a week is amazing and takes so much of the mental load off. So actually, the, yeah, close adult family members are enormously supportive, and I basically couldn't do what I'm doing at the moment without them. Like, I feel like we're a real functional team, and I hope that they realise that I've got enormous gratitude for them.
Oh,
wonderful. I'm sure they love being an integral part of your family and seeing your boys, and you know, they did their time, didn't they? Your mum did those hours, and she did, you know, hopefully now she's getting a little bit of a piece of maybe some of the stuff she missed. So
yeah, I mean, she took 6 weeks maternity leave with my brother and 8 weeks with me.
Oh my goodness.
And breastfed, like, just pumping between patients.
What a legend. I hope she writes a book one day.
I mean, on the one hand, legend, yes, but on the other hand, what a mug. Because in the 1980s, I get the impression that feminism was not just the option to do it all, but almost the obligation to do so. And she really wanted to show to the male GP partners that she could do it all.
Mm.
Why?
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
And, you know, she really wanted a third child and didn't have one because she was so exhausted. You know, I hope we've moved away from that a bit, and that actually we think that feminism is about choice rather than an obligation to prove that you can do everything all the time, like some sort of Wonder Woman.
Yeah, you've summed that up perfectly.
Thank you so much, Vicky, for joining us today. I've learned so much from you, and it's been a really, really enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Vicky. So nice to meet you at last. Claire's told me so much about you, and I'm just so inspired to go and find some medical books and put my nose in them now and have a bit of a read.
Thanks very much for having me.